You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
For those of you who would like to take the floor now, please briefly introduce yourself for the purposes of the conference record. The floor is now open for interventions. Beena Agrawal.
Thank you. I'm a professor currently at the University of Manchester. I want to raise a general question to, firstly, it was an excellent panel, so thank you very much. We really need to ask ourselves under what conditions does cooperation arise? What leads to it? It's a very old question because, as we know, standard economic theory argued, Olson et al., that people will not cooperate because there'll be free riding. Now, we've moved very substantially beyond that to recognize that trust and reciprocity, etc., become the cement on which people do cooperate, and there are many, many examples of cooperation. But it's still, the question does remain, why do people cooperate? And I think there's something fundamental that here. Do people cooperate for strategic reasons because it's economically or otherwise valuable? I think the poor do cooperate when it's necessary for them to cooperate. How do we move from that to the whole idea of cooperating for other regarding values? Now, none of the examples that have been given suggest all the examples that I can think of, including many that were posed, are examples of people cooperating for very strategic reasons. Social movements, people come together for that purpose. They are sporadic. They can be ad hoc. And that doesn't necessarily mean they're cooperating on a long-term basis. So it doesn't necessarily involve a shift in values. The second very related issue is, how do you deal with conflict? Because the sort of notion that communities are somehow homogeneous units, they'll all come together, whether it's for alternative energy or anything else, we know is not the case. There are rich and poor. There are gender differences. There are caste and race differences. And surely, within a theoretical framework, we need to recognize both prospects of cooperation and of conflict. And the third is, it's like social capital. There's a dark side to it. We didn't really see the Frankenstein element or any example of that. But the rich can also cooperate. In the examples of businesses cooperating, unions can be very exclusionary. They can be exclusionary of informal sector workers. They can be exclusionary by gender. So the question is really, what are we talking about if we are, as we are, concerned about the poor, about the people coming together, then we have to see who comes together, what is it that they have to deal with if the poor come together, what kinds of conflicting situations, and what brings them together as a point. So these are questions. I do want to say, Justin, that I disagree with all the examples you've given because I don't think they actually are doing what you suggest. Microcredit does not produce capital in common of the group. They have liabilities in common, and they have in group liabilities and individual borrowings. And so so is also the case with the other examples. Thank you.
The gentleman over there, please.
I'm George. I'm a business person. My company is Bird, and I'm registered at ECOSOC as a civil society. I totally agree about what the speakers said previously, but we are not learning so many things. Firstly, associations and charities or associations or informal organizations has always existed since the earth is earth. It has always existed. Globalization has always existed as well. We are dealing today with a new scale of those phenomena, which is solidarity economies and globalization. It's just today we have to deal with speed, and this is a speed we have to fight. It's not reorganizing informal societies or trying to change how globalization works, because those things have always existed. Even today, we are just talking about modern globalization, which is adding a new dimension, which is a speed. That's a speed we cannot control. Another thing is, of course, informal society works well. It can save people's life. It can save people's well-being. It can look like Greece, We all know that Greece has not so much unemployment because of the informal sectors. That's where people are hiding. We don't count unemployed people. We don't count people who are suffering because they are all working in informal sectors. And the church plays a great role and a great part. Religion plays a great role in helping poor people to save their life during the period of crisis. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Jean-Michel Servet, I will speak French.
The first comment I wanted to make regarded David Barkin's presentation. The reservations that you mentioned regarding the financial interventions you spoke about in social and solidarity economy, it seems to me these can be quite well understood, but nonetheless, if we look at, let's say, the means available to move in a different direction, taking account of the weight of funding issues, that is, the fact that this occupies a very large range of the way in which society operates. We find ourselves here in Geneva. Geneva's one of the capitals of commodity speculation. A certain quantity, for example, of wheat, if you look at that on the market, from the moment it's harvested to the moment it's delivered, there are 2,000 or in excess of 2,000 transactions undertaken on that wheat. It seems to me that we need to operate through international guarantee funds in order to reach a particular aim, but it's particularly difficult if we look at the financialized world not to act through finance and all of these systems. The second comment is more general, and that's the difference between social economy and solidarity economy, because there is one, I think. If you look at social economy, that derives from the 19th century, where a fight was brought to build democracy, and that led to the principle of one man, one voice, or one voter, one voice, to avoid the issue of gender. It seems to me that that process has now been brought to bear in the solidarity economy by dint of the fact that a number of projects have gone beyond this type of one person, one vote system and involve stakeholders in a range of diverse programs. And it seems to me that that characterizes a certain difference if compared to the previous systems and brings to mind the fight for democracy. Thank you.
Last intervention, yes.
Okay, my name is Julia Sahibian. I'm a professor both at university. Can you hear?
Yes.
Both at University of Puerto Rico and at Dalhousie University in Canada. And I'm a business professor, and I work in Cuba. What I'm actually trying to do in Cuba is to encourage the Cuban government to consider these conceptions of the social economy as a way to structure their liberalization of their national markets. So one of the things that becomes extremely confusing for me in my mind is the sense that I've picked up from the interventions that there is this kind of unsolvable problem with capitalism and liberalism, right? Which, of course, the Cubans would agree. So as we're trying to say, well, it's okay to allow more non-state sector, private enterprise, and so on and so forth, and they're wondering what that form would take, must the additional step, in your mind, of this being an alternative to liberalism and capitalism be taken? Or is it possible to say that the social and solidarity economies, even though they're not necessarily the same, et cetera, could actually become and be a further elaboration, a further demonstration or expression of capitalism and liberalism, and that is just fine? Or must you take the extra step? Assuming that what we're trying to do is create employment, assuming that what we're trying to do is create solidarity, assuming all that, It's almost like, must it have a conceptual, almost belonging to something different? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I will be short. Yes, my name is Riyad Bazia. I'm an independent consultant based in Geneva. I just want to make a comment, and thank you very much to organize this meeting and for all speakers. That I want, what I want to say that social and social economy, it recognizes social solidarity, but it's not based on limitation and exceptions, which means if we are facing to social entrepreneurship and illegal institutions, for example, using new technologies and protecting environment doesn't mean monopolize. And secondly, enhancing public goods. And also what I want to raise that including also youth empowerment and youth empowerment, jobs for youth. And last point, what I want to raise, as I heard from the first comment, as a former member of Coordination Office for NGOs in the UN since more than one decade, distinction between a civil society and social movements, that NGOs who are active in the international level, but since the globalization era, social movement, it means recognize international solidarity to facing the challenges free trade. And one of the most important institutions is Via Campesina. And Via Campesina is active in all over the world to try to alternative for negotiation in WTO. But social movement recognize solidarity, especially in agriculture and food sovereignty. Thank you very much.
I'd now like to give a very brief opportunity to the two speakers to whom most of the questions were directed to respond very briefly. Just a minute, please, and then the ILO would like to, our host would like to take the floor.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It's very interesting question which Professor Beena Agarwal raised. Well, it's really a very complex question. But I very strongly feel that this kind of question comes up because we tend to think competition and cooperation as opposing ways of adaptation to particular situations. One of the reasons I have been saying that non-dualism is to emphasize this part and to say that there is a continuation, you know, that there is no contrast between the two. On the other hand, if you look at the practical behavior of human beings, it depends on the situational practical logic. And to me, as a student of sociology, I would say that cooperation is the foundation on which we build our social lives, and competition is based on our cooperation. It's just not an isolated process. You know, you have to understand competition within the framework of cooperation. That's a quick answer, I think, from my side.
Thank you very much, Professor Dash. Professor Bakin.
The questions highlight particularly the depths of the jumps of the changes we have to make in our way of thinking. Beena's analysis of the difficulty of cooperation and the self-centeredness of the basis for cooperation reflects part of the fundamental problems that the economics profession has. I would suggest that if we have to think about constructing a social solidarity society on the basis of economic self-interest, I think we will not move ahead. The notion that communities engage in a change may not be based, cannot be based, upon the circuit of rationalities, the notion of rationalities that are based upon organizing society in terms of individual self-interest. This is a very, very large discussion, and it is based And it is very, very important to understand, I believe, that to move toward the social solidarity economy, we have to move beyond the notion of the economy at the center of the way in which people are organized. To be quite concrete and to address some of the other questions, I think that the issue of how we provide food through international markets that was asked by the person, I didn't get your name, who asked in French, illustrates the extraordinary danger and difficulties of an economy which is based upon international sourcing rather than on local sourcing. And the last question that was derived on work in Cuba suggests a particularly thorny question, and that is, or the penultimate question, and that is, how do we move to reorganize the way in which production is reorganized on a cooperative basis, on a solidarity basis, within a society that is mutually supportive? I would argue that there's enough evidence right now internationally to suggest that before we worry about the problem of creating full employment, we must eliminate the problem of labor as the way of the labor market as the way in which society meets basic social needs. In the Cuban case, in particular, which I have been directly involved in for a long time, I think that the notion of creating social property owned by the workers through the cooperative mechanisms and guaranteeing a basic consumption or basic needs package through a social decision is an alternative to worrying about, to starting from the point of creating sufficient jobs. Once a society agrees that its first obligation is to satisfy the basic needs of the people, then creating employment is a different kind of problem.
So I've been asked to be really brief, and I will, and I encourage anybody who has a question to come up and talk to me afterwards. Just really simply the question of cooperation. I don't think we make people cooperate, and I think the reason why people cooperate are for two reasons. One, for need, and two, for values. And how those conditions are created for people to cooperate, one is very negative and one's very positive. And I think that we need to actually think about that process. In terms of dealing with conflict, that's a question that exists in all systems and for all time, and you have to actually practice conflict resolution. Just really quickly on the microcredit issue, the problem is that people conceptualize microcredit simply as something like Grameen. You have examples like credit unions, which have existed for a very long period of time, which don't rely on the things that you're concerned about, and I think you have to have a broader understanding. And really quickly, the capitalism and liberalism are just fine. Inside of Cuba, I think the laws that I've seen, at least, are based on usufruct. And it's not a communist system, it's not a capitalist system, it's actually trying to get at this issue of a more social understanding of economies. Thank you.
Check out our other podcasts, available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. Thank you for listening.